Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Kathy, I would like to move that the Audits and Investigations Committee certify to the best of each member's knowledge, and with no individual member dissenting, that at the just concluded executive session of the Audits and Investigations Committee of November 5th, 2015, only such matters as are authorized for discussion in executive session under Board Bylaws Article 10, and only those matters identified in the notice by which the executive session was convened, were heard, discussed, or considered by the committee.
Second.
Motion. Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Thank you very much,
Thank
Mr.
you.
Cochran. And let me officially call the Customer Service and Operations Committee to order. Before we get started, we have our first of all, Mr. Brown, Chief Safety Officer Training, is going to start out with our meeting with with the safety report. Here we go, and we can get started. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's not Mr. Brown.
In case of an emergency, please use the exit you enter through or use the exit in the front of the room to exit to the outside and gather over by the building using. Also, there's an AED out at the guard station if we need one. Today's safety contact will focus on ladder safety as it's the season for cleaning gutters and installing holiday decorations. Over a quarter of a million people went to the ER last year because of ladder-related injuries, according to the CDC. The main thing to keep in mind when preventing an injury is that ladders should be considered a tool, and many of the basic safety rules that apply to most tools also apply to the safe use of a ladder. Some points to consider include wearing slip-resistant shoes, inspect the ladder to confirm that it's in good working condition before use, look above for any overhead wires or obstructions, have a helper support the base while a ladder is being used, ensure that the duty rated posted on the side of the ladder is greater than the total weight of the climber, tools, supplies, and other objects being placed on that ladder. Ensure that the length of the ladder is sufficient so that the climber does not have to stand on the top rung, or if climbing onto a roof using an extension ladder, be sure the ladder extends 3 feet beyond the roof line. Use the 3 points of contact rule, which is that at all times the climber must face the ladder and have 2 hands and 1 foot, or 2 feet and 1 hand in contact with the ladder, steps, rungs, or side rail. And finally, remember the 4-to-1 rule when placing a ladder, which is for every 4 feet of height you climb, move the base 1 foot away from the wall. That concludes today's safety contact.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kupta. And Mr. Brown is in training today, so thank you very much. Before we start the committee meeting, I'd like to take time to go to the Assistant General Manager for Transit, Mr. Off, to give us an announcement regarding the Transit Infrastructure Engineering Services. Mr. Off?
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Good morning. We are pleased to announce that effective at opening this coming Saturday, the speed restrictions in place as an effect of the Stadium Armory substation fire of September 21st will be removed. Further, the skip-stop operation wherein Orange Line and Silver Line trains do not service Stadium Armory during weekday AM and PM rush will also be eliminated, and all trains will resume the servicing of Stadium Armory. Unfortunately, we are not able to return to 6-minute headways on the Orange Line and the Silver Line. This return to near-normal service patterns is realized due to the efforts of our electrical engineers and electrical maintainers who devised a temporary configuration at the adjacent Potomac Avenue substation, which enables this substation to now deliver 7 megawatts of power to the system as compared to its previous output of 4 megawatts. The recovery efforts at the Stadium Armory substation are not complete. However, this work is progressing well ahead of schedule, and we anticipate energizing this substation on or about Thursday, the 26th of November, Thanksgiving Day. That said, test results and conditions on the ground will continue to dictate when the Stadium Armory substation can be safely energized. Once this work is complete, we intend to then return to 6-minute headways on the Orange and Silver lines. Delivering a safe and reliable rail infrastructure is my responsibility, and we will continue to allocate the proper resources as expeditiously as possible to fully restore normal service to our Orange Line and Silver Line customers. The information noted above will be released publicly via our Stadium Armory webpage and a news release immediately following this announcement. Pending any questions, this concludes our announcement. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. Yes, sir.
It's a great response for our riders. I think you heard it in the audience. I'm sure there are some riders, and we look forward to continue to move as expeditiously on the rest of this project. So thank you very much. Great work. Let us now begin the meeting. I may have a motion to approve the agenda for today.
So moved.
Mr. Bolger, I'm approving a second. And I know there's a second. Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
And opposed? Okay. I'm awake, too. The minutes before us, motion to approve the minutes of the September 10th. A motion? Mr. Gustin,
second.
Mr. Bolger, any questions? All those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed? Thank you very much. On today's agenda, we have one action item, and we have two informational updates. And before we get started on the first item, I wanted to thank the board members for their full participation and suggestions during the September customer service meeting. We had a very big chuck-full meeting, and there were lots of questions and discussions. Conversation was focused on two areas that I would like Jack and the management team to address at the December customer service meeting. The first is how the customers will receive information from Metro today about our service and disruptions on rail, bus, and in our stations. And the second was on how Metro both receives and responds to information on these requests of services. Addressing the two topics will give us a framework from which to build with our further thoughts and suggestions. And now I'd like to quickly look at today's agenda. On the agenda was the first item is the action item. Mr. Kent, and Assistant General Manager for Access Services, and Dr. Terry Clower, Deputy Director of George Mason University Center of Regional Analysis, will present results of a study on the long-term sustainability of Metro access and recommendations for various policies for sustainability of the service into the future. Next, we will hear from Ms. Burnside, our Chief Performance Officer, and she will provide the review of Metro's performance indicators for the third quarter of 2015 and the steps Metro is taking to make improvements. Our final item is to review the input from the Metro input that Metro received from its customers this fall regarding the proposed changes to bus service. Staff undertook extensive outreach as part of Metro's public participation plan. The committee will then act to approve service changes based on this the customer input and staff recommendations. Based on some previous actions, these adjustments, which are budget neutral, are expected to measurably improve both ridership and reliability on the routes that are changed. The changes also continue the board's commitment to review possible improvements outside of the budget cycle. And with that, I'd like to begin the first item, which is the information item, Mr. Kent, and welcome Mr. Clower from George Mason. And this is the sustainability study on Metro access. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you and good morning.
Morning.
This
morning.
Is an information item on the forecasted demand for Metro access service and strategies for ensuring its future sustainability. Last year, we marked the 20th anniversary of the Metro access paratransit service. Metro Access was created in response to the requirement for complementary paratransit service as described in the Americans with Disabilities Act. The purpose of complementary paratransit is to preserve the civil right of access to and use of public transit for people with disabilities. Although Metro's bus and rail services have been fully accessible for some time, the nature of disability still requires that we provide paratransit service as a safety net for those whose needs cannot be met on fixed route transit. Next slide. As part of the FY 2015 budget process, the board directed staff to conduct a study on the long-term sustainability of Metro access, and we turned to George Mason University to serve as our research partner. I am joined this morning by Dr. Terry Clower, director of GMU's Center for Regional Analysis, who will present the study's findings on demographic trends and future growth projections. But first, I would like to provide some context. Metro access started out small. In 1994, the budget was only a few million dollars per year with five-figure ridership. As it became apparent that the need for this type of service was increasing, rapid growth in the early 2000s quickly outpaced Metro's infrastructure, and by 2004, Metro found itself on the receiving end of a class action lawsuit citing poor service. At this point, ridership was growing as much as 30% per year, and the fare was a flat $2.50 for a one-way trip. As a stopgap measure to manage the growth, the board introduced the free ride benefit to eligible Metro Access customers. In 2006, Metro began a new service contract that fortified Metro Access with new technology, vehicles, and substantially greater resources for our contract operators. Following these improvements to service, Metro Access became the mode of choice for more than a million customers with disabilities. And since Metro provides this service as a civil right, every request for service is honored and no one is turned away. As a result, Metro Access ridership and expense both doubled between FY 2006 and FY 2010, from 1.2 million to 2.4 million passengers per year, and from $52 million in budget to $104 million in expense. In FY 2010, we examined the Metro Access business practices to identify ways to improve efficiency without compromising quality. And we also focused on ways to redirect ridership to fixed route services. This is our demand management strategy, and as you will see in a moment, it worked, at least for a time. Our efforts were further strengthened by the decisive action taken by the board to set the service area and fare policy to the most favorable allowed by ADA. We looked internally to identify cost-saving measures, and this slide highlights a few of the most impactful measures, things like directly purchasing fleet vehicles and fuel. Based on Metro's tax-exempt status, we were able to put money back on the bottom line. Most noteworthy was the recent and seamless transition of services to the new set of contracts that started in 2013. It's very rare that this happens so quietly. It's also very rare that the previous contract, having 8 years' worth of pricing, only increased by 2% from the last year of the old contract to the first year of the new contract. There was great interest in operating the Metro Access service. We had 17 companies bid on the contract, so we were really able to get the best value for the authority through that process. And we continue to leverage competition in the new business model with multiple contractors being graded on their performance that they deliver to our customers. And most importantly, since we started operating the new business model, and almost immediately, in fact, we did see a 27% increase in our productivity measure, which is passengers per revenue hour. This is our primary measure of efficiency, and this is certainly an impressive improvement from one model to the other. In addition to the efficiencies gained, we've also been successful in reducing costs through aggressive promotion of paratransit alternatives. For the first time in its 21-year history now, Metro Access experienced decreases in ridership between FY 2011 and FY 2013, as you see in the illustration. However, the aging of America is working against us as people live longer and tend toward disability as they age. So at this time, I would like to invite Dr. Clower to present the study's findings on these demographic trends and their implications. Dr. Clower, let me give you the microphone, sir.
Thank you very much, and good morning. What we did with this analysis was to do some projections based on population projections, taking into account factors such as age demographics and of course, the propensity for disabilities within given populations, and then look at a couple of different scenarios, one of a baseline of if things stay about the same, demand management techniques that have already been in place stay the same, one that would incorporate several policy initiatives that that Christian will talk about here in a few minutes, and then another one where what we see happening is something that we saw particularly in the period of time during the Great Recession and the years thereafter, where human service agencies that also provide these type of services were actually pulling back on their provision of transit services and pushing that population into WMATA access. Just as give you, to save a little time, the notion is we're getting older. And while that's on average pretty good news, it's better than the alternative, it's going to come with some cost to it. And if we look at just what's going on now, we will see an increase on a compounded average growth rate of about 3.6% per year. That would indicate to you that your current demand for WMATA access services will grow from about 2.1 million rides per year to about 3.1 million rides per year by 2025. Now, within that band of possibilities, you have saying that if you employ additional strategies and additional policies and cooperation with regional entities to help shift some of that demand across the region, then you look at that being closer to about a 1.7% growth rate, which takes you down then to only an increase of roughly about a half a million. So again, no matter what scenario you look at, your demand is going to increase. It is going to continue to consume a lot of resources to provide these necessary services. On the other hand, if we see that trend of what we saw in the post-recession years continue to where local agencies are having to shift demand onto the access services, that growth rate goes up to 5.3%, and we'd be talking about a 2025 ridership of about 3.7 million riders, with obviously the attendant cost implications. One thing to that. Understand, this is not a DC-centric, a regional-centric problem. This issue is being faced by every transit system across the country. We are an aging population overall. And so please understand that there are, and some of the things that we looked at were issues and best practices from these other jurisdictions. So understand, we're not on some island, and the challenges that this board is facing in addressing this issue is one that's very much a universal problem in this country.
Thank you, Dr. Clower. It's something that we say internally all the time. Metro Access is now the fifth largest paratransit service in the country, and I don't say that very often because people develop a cringe when I say that, because it's one of the few services where ridership increases are not considered success. And I hearken back to what I said at the beginning, which is that this service really was meant to simply be a contingency for people who could not use bus and rail. But at the time that the ADA was created, I think the appreciation for the need for this type of service was really, I mean, it was there, but not to the magnitude that we've seen in recent years. And of course, the ADA itself has evolved over time. You know, even in our discussions with the FTA, the way that the regulations are interpreted, they're being interpreted more and more favorably to different kinds of accommodation for the customer. So the theme here that we're really talking about is, what is Metro Access supposed to be? If Metro should take the service and evolve it into something more like a human service agency, where we provide not only transit but also custodial care and other types of support services, we've now moved into another line of business, and there are expenses that are associated with this. So the recommendations that we're discussing are twofold, and the next slide, we'll start with the first. With demand management, obviously it was even the intent of the ADA to leverage fixed route service as much as possible, and that we have already done. The board established the free ride benefit in 2004. That's been going on for some time. We also do travel training throughout the region to help people who've never tried bus and rail before to make use of the accessible Metro bus and Metro rail systems that we have. But beyond that, on the next slide, it's these other solutions that are more jurisdictionally based that I think in the long run are going to have the greatest impact. And they're in a couple of areas. First, there's just the notion that Metro does not necessarily have pride of authorship. We don't have to be the sole provider of this type of service, and we probably shouldn't be, because our purpose here, again, is to provide transit. the need out there in the community for specialized transportation is a combination of a need to get around, but also to have their special needs as people with disabilities met. There are organizations throughout the region that are vocational programs, human service agencies that have the clinical expertise to take care of those needs and at the same time with their staffs provide transportation. In years past, that was the model, and what's evolved over time is that as the human services sector's budgets shrink, those customers are being referred to public transit. So what we need to do is establish more of a cooperative relationship between public transit and the human services sector. At the recent APTA conference in San Francisco, there was a special session that the FTA had conducted. I had the opportunity to attend where the FTA has been in dialogue with healthcare companies and health insurance companies to talk about ways to pool these types of resources. So as Dr. Clower said, there's a national focus on this issue as well as what's happening here in Washington. So without going over these in detail, I kind of want to save some time at the end for questions on these. So I'm just going to go, if I could, to the last slide here that we put together, we put together this chart that summarizes the policy recommendations and talks about how we intend to implement each of these, many of which are already in progress. We intend to report back to you at least annually on these, and each item has a measure, so we'll be able to give you in very specific terms how effectively we've implemented these recommendations and how well they're doing. So the first one, of course, is bus stop accessibility. The board already has a KPI on this. I'm pleased to say that in our first year, we've already exceeded the KPI, so that's good news by almost 100%. So we're off to a great start there. Accessible bus stops mean more fixed route usage by our paratransit customers. We've discussed travel training. We do have a reduced fare program that allows customers with qualifying disabilities to ride bus and rail at half fare without having to apply for or use Metro Access at all if they don't need it. And this is in addition to the free ride benefit that all conditionally eligible Metro Access customers now enjoy. We've talked a little bit about the enforcement of conditional eligibility in the past. This item, I would just simply say, means that there are some customers who they are technically eligible to use paratransit, but only in certain circumstances. Up until this point, we have only used this classification as a data point. We've not enforced it. We don't question the Metro Access customers when they make a reservation as to whether the conditions for that particular trip satisfy. This is something that in order for us to begin any kind of enforcement, it's going to take a great deal of collaboration and consultation with our Accessibility Advisory Committee and the community to make sure that we're interpreting those conditions favorably to the customer and not impeding their use of the service. But it's in our business plan to explore that. We are advocating, as the GMU study says, to maintain the current policies on the service area and on the fare structure for Metro Access because we believe that those actions have had a favorable effect on the service. They are consistent with what the ADA permits, and they support the demand management strategy that's already borne fruit here in recent years. I would go to the vehicles for human service agencies. Metro Access vans have a useful life of 4 years. What we have done in some cases, most of the time those vehicles are auctioned off at the end of their useful life, but we have had some circumstances where we're permitted once they no longer have any federal interest in them, they can be donated under policy as long as the authority can demonstrate that it was of value to us. There's a great value in taking vehicles that could still be used beyond those 4 years to perpetuate services that otherwise, if they stopped, would move more customers to Metro Access. There are some vehicles that we have that upon 4 years, they still have some residual federal interest value in them. We have another option. The option is to transfer the grantee status from Metro to the Human Service Agency. It would be kind of like assuming a loan. They take the vehicle, they are now responsible for all the associated reporting requirements. We would like in the future, actually as early as next month, to start submitting to you simple board resolutions authorizing these types of transfers. We have two agencies already that qualify, and you know, because of the fact that you know it involves the FTA and it involves the transfer of this responsibility, each time we do it, we'll be submitting to you a request to approve the resolution to do so. So that is another way where we've really been able to head off what was previously viewed as inevitable increases in ridership on Metro Access. And the last point that I'll touch on here, there are references on the screen to a brokerage concept or jurisdictional services. There are other ways to meet the needs of customers with disabilities. In Maryland and in the district, we have a couple of programs that have proven to be very successful in accomplishing this, most notably the Transport DC program in the district, where the district's ample taxi resources are being used for eligible Metro Access customers to be able to travel spontaneously, and they love it. It's reached 10,000 trips per month. It's been very, very successful, and it's still climbing. And when customers make use of that service in the district, that offsets what otherwise would be a trip that's probably another $20 per trip more expensive than it would have to be otherwise. So we're really, really pleased with how Transport DC has worked. In Maryland, there have been two pilot programs that we have implemented in partnership with MDOT, where human service agencies have been enabled to provide their own transportation, as we spoke of earlier. And those have also produced favorable savings. But more importantly, the customers like it because they are being served by people who understand their needs very well. That's their profession. So it really is a win-win. We'd like to do more of this. So if there was an ask of the board at the end of all this great news is that we want to do more of these types of partnerships, but we need to be able to speak to each jurisdiction about how to put those partnerships together, and we need points of contact, liaisons within each jurisdiction who can speak to these prospects, not just in an operational perspective, but also a financial one. So with the ability to do that, and then we'll go to the last slide, we'd like to have a regional dialogue about all of the above. We've approached the Council of Governments. We've talked with the Executive Director and the Director of Transportation Planning there. Both of them are eager to take this on and help us to bring these jurisdictions together. They are currently in the process of combining their Access for All and Human Services Transportation Coordination Task Force into a single group and bringing more stakeholders there. So we have the opportunity to have this discussion on a regional level, but we just want to have the right players at the table when those discussions take place. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Kent. And let me apologize and say thank you and apologies. So you were here prepared last meeting, and we had to delay you, but it was very important that you provide the information to us, particularly your response to the study, Mr. Clower, is very important to the work that we do. Let me open it up, and I'll start with Ms. Porter, and I'll come back this way, okay?
Thank you very much. I really think that was an excellent report, and I appreciate the work that went into doing it. I'm very glad, Mr. Kent, that you mentioned at the end the accessible taxi cab, and I congratulate my colleagues in the district for a very successful program. It was a little difficult to get off the ground, but it's the first one in the area, and it has proven to be, as you mentioned, very popular with not just people who are eligible for Metro Access, but the entire disabled community in the district. And it also costs us, when we basically pay for a trip, what less than half of what a regular Metro Access trip would cost. And I believe Montgomery County is working on developing a similar program. So this is something that, while not, you know, easy or free, and I believe the district had some federal New Freedom money to begin that program, if I remember correctly. But it's the kind of thing that could be implemented with less effort than some other things that we're talking about, but has an enormous payoff. And it's something that we, the jurisdictions, could do, even in the jurisdictions that already have their accessible services, because it is more convenient for the users and also much less expensive for the payers. The other thing that I wanted to talk about for just a second was my understanding, and I know this gets fairly complicated, my understanding is that someone who has a Metro Access eligibility is not eligible just for the reduced fare, but is eligible for a free fare. Is that correct?
They're two separate programs.
Okay, now, okay, so can you explain that, please?
Sure. The reduced, I pulled it closer. Yes, there are two separate programs. The reduced fare program or disability ID program comes from the Federal Transit Act. It's an economic benefit only, and it's easier to qualify for it because, again, it's not associated with the eligibility criteria for paratransit service. So a customer can come to our eligibility office here at Jackson Graham and apply for this separately. They get a half fare smart card that has their photo ID printed on it, and they're able to use that for all of the trips they take on bus and rail. The free ride benefit only applies to customers who are eligible for Metro Access and specifically conditionally eligible. You know, when we brought this item to the board in 2009, we were asked, why only the conditionally eligible? Because shouldn't we give everybody the chance to try fixed route? And the answer is absolutely we want to do that. But we want the customer to disclose to us that they do have the ability to use bus and rail. That's an important data point for us. So what has happened is that when we do assess customers, if they come in and they tell us, and again, we do an assessment, but if they tell us that they do have some ability to use bus and rail, or if that's the result of our functional assessment, then they get an appropriately marked Metro Access ID card, and upon showing that ID to a station manager or bus operator, they can ride those services for free.
So thank you very much. I appreciate that. So the point of my question was if we can think about additional classes to which we could expand the free ridership. I had the opportunity this past Tuesday to do a meet and greet with riders in Bethesda, and I spoke with a woman who said that she would use it more often if she could get the free ridership rather than the reduced fare. So it seems that there are people who would do that, and that might be a way, because we certainly save a lot for each rail trip or bus trip that people take and not Metro Access. So those would be two suggestions I have that we might be able to consider. And thank you very much for the thorough report.
Thank you, Ms. Porter. Mr. Downey?
Yeah, and thank you also. A very good piece of work. I think it will have national consequences as people look at it. But I wanted to follow the money. When we carry a person on Metro Access, and we incur $40 or whatever it costs, and they pay something less, it's my understanding that basically that gap drops directly to the bottom line and becomes part of what the jurisdictions have to pay us in terms of subsidy. And the point of that is we're all in better financial situation if we can make some of these strategies work. It isn't saving money for Metro. It is saving money for the jurisdictions who would otherwise have to foot the bill. So, you know, I think getting the COG group together and putting that fiscal consequence on the table is, I think, a very important part of the discussion.
No, thank you. Mr. Downey, I appreciate you expanding that because I think the number is closer to 52.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, a rider. And we're giving the rider a greater opportunity as well. So there are lots of return benefits. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Ms. Hines and then Mr. Goldman.
So thank you very much for the report, Dr. Clower. Nice to see you. It's interesting, Christian, because lately you've been talking a lot about the innovations that are going on in D.C. and Maryland, and we on the Virginia side, we applaud all of those innovations. But I can't sit here and not remind everybody that for more than 10 years, Arlington has had an alternative service that has better on-time performance and higher satisfaction ratings from our riders than they give Metro Access. And it is because it's local. It does go everywhere, but you have to pay a price to go everywhere. The vast majority of the trips are within our Zone 1, which is pretty much Arlington and a couple of hospitals that are right outside of our area. And it's saved us a huge amount of money because, as Mort says, it doesn't fall to the jurisdictions as a region that cost, it falls directly to your jurisdiction where that ride starts. So it's hugely important for our local budgets to attend to this, and we've had great success with it. And I think as a percentage of our population, we may have the highest number of people with disabilities living in Arlington because it is so convenient to live in Arlington from an accessibility point of view. But anyway, I just didn't want anybody listening to think Virginia's not doing anything. We've been in the game a long time.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, General, Mr. Kent, and Mr. Grauer for your report. Mr. Kent, I wanted to just explore with you an option that I don't see specifically addressed in your action plan. And I want to introduce it by saying that when I was in San Francisco for the APTA conference, I noticed that Uber now has both vans as well as a pooling service. And I assume their competitor Lyft does the same thing. So it occurred to me that one option for a lot of our disabled riders who are ambulatory and don't need the kind of full service that the Metro Access vehicles provide would be to have some kind of a solicitation to an Uber or Lyft to see if they wanted to provide a service to our ambulatory, you know, riders, and you know, people could have an app and contact them directly, and they would pick up one or two and take them people to where they wanted to go at, as Mr. Downey points out, at a much lower cost, both for the program as well as for the jurisdictions. Is that something that's been tried anywhere in the nation, and is that something you've thought about and are trying to work up a solicitation along those lines?
Well, yes, and actually that's a great point. Uber is definitely interested. There are a lot of companies like Uber, transportation network companies, that are interested in getting into the paratransit business. At APTA, Uber was described as a disruptive technology, and it certainly has been disruptive in many ways to taxi entities across the country. We partner with taxi services now in Metro Access, and one of the reasons why taxi has been such a helpful partner to paratransit is because the taxi operators have been willing to adopt procedures and training that are catered to serving the disability community. When Uber and other companies like them talk to public transit agencies, that's kind of usually the center of the conversation, is that there has to be a discussion of what the requirements would be, what the needs of our customers are. And that's why I think your suggestion of a solicitation is right on point, because we'd want to articulate what those expectations and requirements are and then see what kind of response that we would get. So that's kind of a piece that we're looking at. Our Accessibility Advisory Committee also has told us that they'd like to see an app, and we have been pushing very hard to develop an app for Metro Access, just so the customer would be able to see when their ride is coming. We have the technology to give them an estimated time of arrival from our reservation system, but we don't have it married to the kind of traffic-based maps that are commonly available, and we don't want to give an ETA that isn't considering traffic. So we're trying right now to work on melding those two technologies together so that when we do offer an ETA that it's an accurate one. And if I could also just take one extra moment to give a nod to what Ms. Hines said about Virginia. Inside the GMU study, the Virginia model is highlighted as being quite successful. Arlington Star Fairfax County's FastTrans service has been in existence since the mid-80s. As a result of these services, Virginia has historically had less dependence on Metro access. And so, that's precisely why we want to talk to all the jurisdictions about trying to do more jurisdictionally based service.
So for this solicitation, which I'll just refer to as the Uber Lyft solicitation, although I recognize other service providers could provide it, what would you see as the timeline? When do you see this solicitation going out, and when do you see we can see whether there's any real interest in the providers in offering this kind of service, and perhaps they would develop the app to go along with it?
Well, I think in the interest of transparency and stakeholder vetting, my first step would be to go to the Accessibility Advisory Committee and discuss requirements, and we have not done that yet. So following that kind of a discussion and getting a more robust appreciation for what the needs are here, that's when we would be able to put together a solicitation. There are no definitive plans to do that this calendar year, but I would think, following favorable input from the committee, it's something that we could look at in the coming year.
Good. Please keep us posted on that. Thanks.
Happy to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Confronted with these daunting statistics, okay, and having seen this in my career in California, one thing that I think I'd like to recommend is that there be some consideration at the TPB or the Council of Governments about whether Annapolis, Richmond, or the District of Columbia should tackle these costs in some legislative policy way. In California, they have a set aside for this kind of service, as you well know, Christian. But I think that was the last straw, that you have to exhaust all of these options that are presented here before you talk to the legislatures about trying to come up with some kind of stable, reliable financing for what's going to be expensive sledding here, going based on your report, the brokerage idea, the coordination with the jurisdictions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I hope that you could add in some kind of a policy framework to discuss last-ditch efforts to corral these costs.
We have done some time ago some Capitol Hill briefings on the subject. The staff.
I'm talking about.
The state level.
The state and the district. And the model I'm giving you is the California model. It's called Article 4.5 of the Transportation Development Act, which goes back to like the 70s for these services. But that was only approved by the California legislature after everybody had to do a coordinated plan with the human services agencies, who are notorious for shedding, they're going to shed as, the best they can. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, could I, since no one else has mentioned it, could I go on record as being very supportive of this meeting, jurisdictional meeting that you're talking about? It seems like a very good first step forward, and it could probably incorporate a lot of the suggestions that have been suggested by the board members here.
Thank you.
Porter, I think that is where we are with this. There are several things, but I think to acknowledge what this presentation is about is transportation options for everyone's changing. And we need to see what it means for the accessibility community and to the best financial model as well as delivery model for everybody. And I think our users want to have flexibility. And we want that flexibility for them, and we need the financial model to help us really deliver the system, not only within the federal guidelines, but with an efficiency level that I think we should be respectful of. So on your next steps, as we've talked through this, I think we have many starts within the Council of Governments, and I think this is just an additional one where we move through. And we look forward to you bringing this back to us as to how we continue to move forward. I go back to the conditional eligibility. It brought a great deal of stress, but it actually has turned out to be the great opportunity for our riders as well as for us from a financial model to Mr. Reckler.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the conversation, and I think I just want to recall that one of the next steps is to identify jurisdictional liaisons. We'd certainly encourage the board members to work with us in identifying those folks. I think what we've heard is this is a bottom line dollar issue with jurisdictions, and this is, I believe, a case where Dr. Clower and Christian would agree that we can reduce costs but improve service at the same time. So, and the other thing that's not on that next step, I volunteer Christian and his staff as a liaison or a catalyst to work with jurisdictions who may not be overly excited, but I think once we handhold you through the process, it can work, it can be beneficial to everyone, and we have the staff that can assist other jurisdictions in improving some of the services that we have. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for emphasizing that, Mr. Requa, and that is exactly what we need to do. Hearing no other questions, I want to again thank you for the presentation, and thank you, Mr. Flowers, for joining us and working on this report. The next item is the vital signs report. Ms. Bernstein is here with the third quarter report, and we have good news and we have not so good news.
Thank you.
Yeah, John. The vital signs report is in the back.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you.
Good morning to members of the committee and members of the board. Thank you. Today I'm going to be summarizing the performance results for the third quarter of calendar year 2015, and that means July, August, and September.
Andrew, could you pull the mic a little closer?
Sure. So let's start with bus. Overall, bus on-time performance improved this quarter as a result of 25% fewer buses running early compared to last year, same time. We saw the typical decline that we see as kids go back to school in September. Last quarter, we committed to evaluating the impact to on-time performance of the bus fare evasion initiative and detours. And what we found that there is a relationship between the fare evasion and on-time performance. Essentially, it makes sense as buses are held longer at stops to better manage and police fare evasion, the on-time performance decreased. And conversely, as fare evasion decreased, the on-time performance increased. In terms of detours, the impact depends on a number of factors, including how well the detour is managed. And we looked at one significant event, the visit of the Pope, that prompted many detours and challenges for bus. And interestingly, we found that bus on-time performance was better this year during the visit than it was the prior year. Kind of an unexpected result. The bus performance improvement team efforts are demonstrating progress. Each month, the team, which employs a street management approach, identifies poorly performing routes and comes up with corrective actions to improve not only on-time performance, but customer service and training. Bus fleet reliability, as you know, we've had challenges with fleet reliability this year, but we're starting to see some steady improvements as this quarter as we approach the target. Fleet reliability was 3% lower than the same time last year. There were 62 more mechanical failures, which caused a bus to be taken out of service. We continue our initiative to correct the NABI hybrid manufacturer-related failures and other subsystem hybrid failures, and these have demonstrated notable progress during the quarter. Particularly during September, the hybrid fleet had the most improved performance compared to the prior quarter. Bus customer satisfaction climbed 6 percentage points in the quarter, a significant increase that raises satisfaction levels to the same quarter as the previous year. And what we learned from the customer surveys is that bus reliability has improved in terms of customer perception. Customers noted better on-time performance. This results in customers recommending service more often this quarter than last, and that's really important because we ask people, would you recommend bus to your friends and family? Compared to the same time last year, bus customers are also experiencing fewer safety concerns on buses and less crowded buses. However, they did note dirtier bus stop environments. Let's move ahead to rail. Rail on-time performance fell below 80% during the third quarter, and that's the worst on-time performance result we've seen since 2010 when vital signs was first published. This is due to a combination of not enough rail cars for service, slower train speeds due to infrastructure problems, less frequent service on the orange-blue silver lines, and red line midday track work, reducing midday and PM rush on-time performance. All these factors together added significantly to customer travel times. Customers experienced significantly longer travel times as train speeds were lowered following the August 6 derailment at Smithsonian to inspect for wide track gauge, and again after the September 21st power substation fire at Stadium Armory that diminished our power capacity. To prevent bunching on orange-blue silver lines, Metro reduced train frequency from 6 to 8 minutes, resulting in longer waits for customers. The good news being, as Mr. Off announced this morning, that challenge is soon coming to an end. Per the board's request, Vital Signs is now displaying rail fleet availability data in addition to reliability. The current key performance indicator of reliability will continue to be reported, but availability is becoming an equally important measure. And that's what I'm going to turn to now. As with quarter one and quarter two of this year, making the higher Silver Line car requirement continued to be a challenge. Metro met the 954 car requirement only 10 out of 64 weekdays during the quarter. A notable exception was a Pope's visit when over 1,000 cars were put into service. And I should note that we purposefully lowered the availability target, as you know, during the summer to 870 cars on Mondays and Fridays, and that's when we have a little bit lighter ridership. And that allowed us to do more maintenance on the cars. By the end of September, over 50 cars were parked due to lack of available parts. With an active fleet of 1,100 cars, this means only about 100 cars could be out of service at any one time in order to meet the 954 car requirement. This would contrast with, if you look back a couple years in 2012 before Rush Plus, we could have up to 250 cars out to be undergoing repair and inspection without impacting service. The base order of 64 7,000 series cars has been delivered to Metro, and 52 rail cars have been conditionally accepted so far. In quarter three, 7,000 series cars performed at about 30,000 miles between delays, and contractually they're required to perform at 25,000 miles between delays during the initial demonstration period. Rail customer satisfaction fell to a new low of 67%. Customers identified train offloading and holding for long periods as part of their experience driving this result. Also, compared to quarter three of the prior year, rail customers experienced less personal security aboard trains, more station crowding, and warmer station conditions. Moving ahead to our safety page. You're going to be hearing more from the interim chief safety officer in a couple weeks during the quarterly safety report, so I'll just briefly go over this. The customer injury rate was 1.7 injuries per million passengers. That's better than target for the first quarter this year. July 2015 had the lowest number of injuries at 25 since Metro began reporting this measure in 2010. More customers were injured on bus compared to rail, but injuries were down in both modes compared to last year. We had fewer collisions, but bus collisions continue to be the driving force behind customer injuries. Employee injury rate beat the target in September for the first time this calendar year. Fewer station managers and train and bus operators sustained injuries. However, at 5.7 injuries per 200,000 hours worked, the rate remains worse than target for the quarter. Overall, there were about 20% more injuries compared to last year. On crimes, the overall Part 1 crimes declined 18% on rail, and those are typically theft, snatches, and pickpockets. However, there was a 51% increase in bus and bus stop and parking lot crimes. And bus stop crimes were generally assault and robbery related, and parking lot crimes primarily involved the destruction of property and theft from autos. And what I hear is that there's a rise in people breaking into cars to steal the handicap placards. Bus operator assaults decreased by 26%, so that's very good news. Verbal altercations or fare disputes triggered a majority of the assaults, with a large portion of the incidents involving bus operators being spat upon. The Fare Evasion Initiative I spoke about earlier and that you're very familiar with deploys police officers on certain bus routes and key rail station gate areas that has resulted in 47% fewer failure to pay citations issued during the month of September alone. And on to our vertical transportation, always a good news story lately and continues to be a good news story. Escalator availability reached 93.2%, better than target and better than last year. There's about 10% fewer unexpected breakdowns and less time spent addressing repairs. On the elevator side, the availability was better than target at 96.9%. Prior efforts to bring the units into a state of good repair continue to pay off, resulting in 25% fewer hours spent addressing unscheduled repairs this quarter. Our modernization effort continued its pace, and modernization accounts for about half of all the outages. We began maintaining the 57 escalators and 30 elevators located on the Orange Line between Rosalind and Vienna, taking over from contractors. And then finally, as we kind of sum all this up, I wanted to let you know we've been talking about an important new measure we're working on and doing the research and development on, which is customer travel time. And we are on schedule to introduce this new KPI in early 2016. This work will allow us also to provide registered smart trip users with individualized views of their own travel times, and that's a goal that we're working towards early next year. We recently completed a survey as part of our research on this of 450 customers to inform the design of the new measure and ensure that it accurately reflects and communicates their experience, and we look forward to sharing the results with the Riders Advisory Council early next month. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bernstein. Let me first open it up for questions. Are there any questions? Just one, Mr. Austin.
Thank you for the report. I was particularly excited about the customer travel time metric, obviously. And I know that you're going to bring it to the Riders Advisory Council, but I also hope that you're going to bring that back to us as well at our next one. I'm really looking forward to seeing what that looks like.
Absolutely. As I said, it'll become a new measure that I talk about on a regular basis as I do the others.
I was just as far as the design, I assume that you were talking to them about the design of it.
Right.
I would hope that we would also be incorporated in that discussion. That's all.
Definitely.
Yeah. Mr. Downey?
Yes. I would also like to commend the staff for working forward on that particular initiative. It reminds me, Mr. Bolger's out of the room, but what is now being done on the highways. Everybody has an iPhone or a GPS. Anonymously, those vehicles are probed, and you get a real-time, real-world measure of travel. And we should be able, with our system, we should be able to do the same thing. More generally, I think the new format of the report is providing transparency on issues, on concerns, suggests in there things that will be done to fix it, and we have to be accountable for delivering those fixes. Now, seeing Mr. Shackelford there, I know he wasn't sitting here just to grace the table. What are we going to do about parts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Procurement is never a panacea, is it? And particularly with regards to spare parts, inventory parts. I'm caught between a rock and a hard place in compliance with rules and law associated with competition. And one of the things that has happened here in my attempts to comply with some guidance that was rendered that requires I use competition on every action regardless of the color of money, specifically the federal source dollars versus the operating source dollars. That has caused havoc since I started seeking competition. And what I'm trying to do now is come forth with a consent item, hopefully we can get it in the November month, that would give me some relief on the non-capital source dollars such that I can go and use non-competitive measures and buy quicker for quicker delivery on those repair parts. It's no secret that that was a restriction that frankly should not have been placed that everything had to be treated competitively. There are sources out there that are OEM and that we must and shall, in order to honor warranty, interoperability, capability, I have to be allowed to go buy those from those OEM sources. My job and my team's job is to make sure I do that with fair and reasonable pricing, and we can consistently deliver that. But right now, my hands are tied simply because of some guidance that was issued, and frankly, from a country boy doing procurement all his life, it's overly restrictive. And I will plead for help in getting that relief and send you that guidance.
Yeah, I certainly would look forward to that discussion. These tight restrictions were put in because the problem that had been created was overwhelming, and we had no choice but to say, get it straightened out. The one thing I would want to be sure about is if we buy things with our own money and not federal money, we have to be sure that those items never find their way into a federal project or a federal grant. So it's not just you, it's you, it's Dennis, it's the operating departments.
Thank you.
Who can deliver on this, but if we can make it work, we should make it work.
Mr. Chair, if I may give you just one example. In simply opening the dialogue with OEMs who have many resellers and distributors, we create this capability recently on something as simple as ordering journal bearings. We were able to save about $500,000 by dealing with OEM distributors and resellers. And essentially, we avoided the sole source nightmare of overpayment. So I look forward to giving that to the GM, and we'll get it up to you guys. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shackelford. Mr. Goldman?
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Burnside. Ms. Burnside, your report is a sobering one. One look at your red lines on the graph for bus and rail, and if I were a physician, I might conclude that the system suffered a coronary during the summer. To cite just two of your numbers, availability of rail cars was below the minimum 954-car threshold every weekday in July and August and most of September. And apropos of Mr. Shackelford's comments, you additionally point out that by the end of September, over 50 rail cars were indefinitely parked due to a lack of parts. I'm not interested in beating up on you and Mr. Troop and the staff for what happened in August or in the third quarter. I'm more interested in knowing where are we today? What has happened during the month of October? Where are we as of November 5? Do we now have 954 rail cars available for a weekday service? Do we still have 50 rail cars parked somewhere waiting for maintenance? Are we doing better today than we were over the summer? That's my question.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Currently, we have 62 rail cars parked for parts. And that being said, you know, procurement is working very, very closely with us and working very deliberately to be able to provide parts for those. You know, we understand the impact that this reliability has. I think, you know, having the opportunity to sit with Mr. Corcoran out at Benning Road and also talking to Councilmember Allen yesterday, you know, that what we recognize is that for a lot of people, this is their only opportunity to be able to get to work. They do not have other opportunities to be able to get to work. So this is abysmal for me as well, because I recognize the impact that this has on people. As part of, in addition to the concept of being able to allocate the parts quicker, what we also have done is I have allocated more overtime into our car maintenance people to be able to do campaigns necessary for this work. Over 60% of our inline delays are a result of car offloads, as a result of brakes in emergency or door propulsion problems, and minority of them being propulsion problems. What that does is we have to offload a train, and we have to recover a train, and we have to get another train in for BIE. That creates two offloads, and that creates a requirement where we have, a gap in service. And again, this gets to the travel time issue, you know, with people with travel times, longer travel times on that. So it's important that we can go out and to do the campaigns, the door campaigns, to be able to get you know, the screw sets on the doors to be able to make sure that they're correct. All the limiting switches and everything are done. And that's a very specific technical skill that we need to be able to do. We need to be able to continue. Right now, for heavy repair and overhaul campaigns, APTA recommends that 5% of your fleet can be in for heavy repair and overhaul. Right now, we have capability for 1% of our fleet to be in a heavy repair and overhaul. We are looking to expand that with the heavy repair and overhaul facility, which we had progressed as part of the 8-car train initiative, and we will continue to talk about the ability to do that. So what happens is we have to bring a car in. Our car maintenance has to bring a car in. We have to set it in there, but it has to be able to get out because we have to get service and inspection people in there. So we can't do the campaigns, the long-term campaigns that we would like to do on that. So that's why I've authorized the use of overtime, to be able to get those cars in, get those cars worked on, get those cars fixed, get them out so that we can make room for other tracks, for the other tracks to be able to do the cars. It's important for us to be able to do that. You know, the doors, the BIEs, to be able, some of the engineering campaigns, to be able to improve those processes are important for us to have the time to be able to allocate to be able to do that. So that's very critical for us in that regard. In regards to the wayside, you know, we worked through August, through after the derailment. We put in the speed restrictions for that. We went out and did significant campaigns utilizing the TGV to check for wide gauge issues. And again, we were not doing temporary fixes out there. We were doing more permanent fixes. Unfortunately for that, that necessitated some late delays. And, you know, when we talk about, I have my delay meeting every morning, 7:30, where you go through, or I have my morning meeting where we talk about issues that we had on the right-of-way over 7:30. You know, try to humanize this element for the people that are working there. Is, you know, somebody gets up at 4:30 in the morning to go to their job. They arrive at the train station at 5 o'clock, and you know they're delayed. It's important for our crews to recognize the importance of being able to allocate the work properly, get out there, get it done, and get off the tracks. So these are some of the initiatives that we're doing in that regard, and also better attention from the Rail Operations Control Center for train spacing, train put-ins, doing those different types of things. So we have campaigns to be able to do that and analysis behind the reasons why we have that. But again, the offloads, because of the door issues, the brakes and emergency issues, and the wayside issues we had recently have contributed to this. Working with Shaq to be able to get the parts procured is important to us, but equally important is to be able to get the time necessary to be able to do those campaigns. So those are things that we're doing. We're not there yet, but we are progressing to that point. Like I said, we just recently allocated the overtime to be able to take care of these cars, and you know, my feeling is we'll be getting parts, you know, very, very soon to be able to get these on. You know, we can't work with a 11% spare ratio, you know, with cars parked. So you know, we have to be able to address these very quickly and put the money and resources behind it that is necessary.
Again, I don't want to beat you up on what happened in the third quarter, but I guess the question that the riders want to know, and I'd like to know, is, because implicitly you're saying we're not back up to 954 available rail cars. When do you expect to get there?
I don't have a time frame for that yet. A lot is dependent upon the allocation of parts. We're working with that. So as soon as we sort of get a better feel on that. But again, what we're doing is we're setting up similar to the way that we did with the campaigns for the Pope's visit, you know, to be able to set up the campaigns, get out there, get the work done, and be able to get to the 954 rail cars, regardless of whether we have 62 parked or not.
I'm reminded of the movie with Patton, where Patton calls in the chaplain, and he says, "Chaplain, I want a prayer for weather. I need clear weather tomorrow. Would that help any? Maybe we could get the..."
I will tell you that clear weather helps significantly for rail cars, so yes.
Thank you.
Just following up on that, is there any way to speed up the delivery of that 7,000 series cars?
Well, right now with the 7,000 series car, there is not. And the reason being, what we have found coming off the assembly line at Lincoln is we've had some quality control issues with coming off the assembly line at Lincoln. We're in deep conversations with Kawasaki about that. I don't want to say that the quality control issues aren't anything significant in regards to the car. You know, it's alignment of seats, alignments of different things like that. There's stop points that they have in their assembly line process to be able to make sure those are. But what we don't want is we don't want to accept the car and get it to our facility and have to work those quality control issues at our facility, which we have done some of that, but we've said we don't want to do that. Mr. Off is going out to Lincoln, Nebraska to visit with them within, I believe, this month to talk about these quality issues. I'm talking at 4 o'clock today with Kawasaki about the quality control issues that they have and that they need to improve on that. So right now, there's not an ability to speed up that process for that. But again, it's moving forward. Once we get through the issues, and again, I want to stress the quality controls issues are significant, aren't related to a safety or structural issues, but they're the quality of the different things that are coming off the assembly line.
Thank you very much, John, for your presentation. Let's go on to the next item, and that is the action item. This is the public hearing staff report on the proposed bus service changes. And Ms. Dombry, you are up. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. True.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be able to come back and report to you on this process that began right after we approved the budget last spring, and we've been working diligently ever since. Going on to the next slide, the purpose here is to present a list of changes to Metro bus services to improve effectiveness, performance, reliability, and ultimately customer satisfaction. We also have some fare changes as part of the package of recommendations, and the board will be approving the service and fare equity analysis for Title VI that's all included in the public hearing docket and all the attached materials. The service impacts, this is the sixth round of State of Good Operations public hearings that we've conducted, and reflects an opportunity for us to implement best management practices for bus services across the region. As you can see, the 81 proposals are distributed across the region, and then there are the specific transfer opportunities, one at Wheaton to take advantage of the red line capacity between Wheaton and Silver Spring, the other to create a virtual bus transfer between Capitol Heights and Addison Road, and lastly, the transit link card to connect to the commuter railroad riders. Next. The proposed service changes are balanced across the region. They improve service in every jurisdiction. They're intended to address the capacity, reliability, convenience, and ultimately customer satisfaction issues that we deal with every day. You heard in the vital signs that we have been improving, but we want to continue to improve. And everything is done within a budget and cost neutral within the current year. In the past 3 years, this process has helped guide over $24 million worth of annual value in terms of shifting resources internally and adding initiative investments. The Title VI findings, there is a memo and all the finding, the details are attached, but the proposed changes meet the compliance. We're well below the threshold, meaning that we're balanced regionally. There's no disparate disparate impact or disbenefits, and the long-range planning staff has been actively engaged as we went through the decision process to reach final recommendations. Customer input, this has been one of the key activities of this public hearing process that makes it unique. It's the first full-blown implementation of the public participation plan. We held over three dozen roadshow events across the region. Several of you participated, including Mrs. Hines, where we had the usual good turnout of Arlingtonians. This year we had double the number of proposals from last year, but triple the amount of input from the public. And I guess key among it is there was significantly more resource invested in the outreach activities. We improved the structure and documentation of what we were doing. had a much larger internet presence, and we really appreciate the support of the external relations and the research folks in assisting the bus planning staff in being able to visit with our riders on bus, at stations, and in meetings. The only thing I would ask is that the Pope not visit us during the public hearing process, because it's the same staff that planned for all those bus changes that are doing this activity. So it made for a really interesting September. This table here is intended to reflect the tone of the total opinions and input provided. We had over 7,300 individual commenters who provided over 21,000 opinions. And in trying to represent what that meant, we came up with this color-coded chart that green is good and yellow is sort of neutral and red is more negative in its context. And it reflects the input from that universe of folks who were commenting, not just individual riders or communities. On the next page, one of the services we were specifically asked to go add to the hearing process was the 5A. The customer reaction was strongly negative. We had, I think, enough comment to represent every rider on the service. Staff recommends maintaining this service at least through the opening of the Silver Line to Dulles Rail, and we will continue to work with Maryland and all the stakeholders involved to identify the necessary budget balances for fiscal 16. Next, the service impacts. The final package of proposals recommended include 57 total items. Many of them are in a different form than they were originally advertised because we did take to heart the public comments and we reflected those in the final recommendations for implementations. I do want to acknowledge the input from all 8 compact member jurisdictions and the state DOTs. We really appreciate their input, their support, and we had numerous spirited conversations with staff about these items. And I do want to make one note that the recommendation on the 28X is contingent upon a federal action. The Defense Department has asked for options to reduce their contribution, so if they reduced it, we would make the change identified. If they do not reduce their contribution, then we would not make that change. But this gives us that procedural opportunity for responding. And then under the tariff proposals, we do want to recommend the Q line transfer from Wheaton to Silver Spring. It's a good opportunity to create a pilot and to allow for riders to get used to using the railroad and perhaps sets us up for a future activity. And then secondly, the Metro bus transfer between Addison Road and Capitol Heights, that was actually something suggested by a member of the public at last spring's public hearing. And it makes real sense tying two bus nodes together, plenty of rail capacity and convenience at no cost, essentially, to the authority. So lastly, the recommendation is to approve these changes, including the fare adjustments, as we've discussed, and the service and equity analysis as contained in the staff report. I thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you, and happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambry. And may I have a motion on the floor first and see if we can move forward.
Madam Chair, I move that we make the changes as recommended by the staff.
And is there a second?
Second.
And now, are there any questions regarding the changes?
I just had one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Jim, can you just explain again the 5A bus route when Silver Line Phase 2 is
finished or prior to that?
Well, the 5A was initially established to provide connectivity for the region to Dulles, and so it will continue to serve that function relatively efficiently and effectively and to the satisfaction of numerous customers, and we would anticipate continuing to operate it until the railroad reaches Dulles, in which case it would become duplicative,
right.
And the intent is at that time we would reevaluate what is needed to properly serve the airport.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay, thanks.
Ms. Hines. I just want to make sure we all understand that the 5A runs before the railroad opens now. So that will be an issue that the board at the time will have to deal with. It's getting a lot of workers out there so they can open up before those 6 o'clock flights. So it's a
broader.
Yeah. It's not a go-away kind of thing. Yeah. It's a conversation that will need to happen.
So I've seen then Mr. Downey.
I want to also talk a little bit about the 5A and actually more broadly just the airport access buses that we have. And so we have both the bus in the Dulles and one that also provides it to BWI. But they are treated differently. The bus, while they both serve the interest of the entire region in moving people from one place out to those airports. In the one case, we have some shared costs across the board versus in that which right now at least serves BWI is not. It falls under the state of Maryland. But they, in essence, serve the same purpose. And so I think that we should definitely talk about how we classify routes, and that perhaps we should look at those things like the bus that's going out to airports and treating them the same way. And then also just more globally, we earlier spoke about the classification process of the bus routes in general. And I think that we definitely need to have that conversation. I don't think that should die. I don't think that should go away. And of course, we are always looking within our various jurisdictions for ways to better optimize, better use our money, better use our resources. And we would want to do that too. We would like to do that equitably. And so I just hope that we'll be able to do that.
Thank you. Mr. Downey, and then I'll have to
come. Yeah, thank you. I was one of the board members who went to the public hearing. And it's really interesting. That was 1% of the total comments. It's good to know a lot of things, but I did want to follow up on what I heard at the hearing just so that people know that I was listening. 5A was clearly one of the key issues and the point that was raised that much of that service is to get people to work to open up the airport. So that's a transportation need. How we meet it, how we allocate different types of routes is an old embedded process. It probably is time to look at that. How do we classify them? Who pays for them? But I don't think this is one where we could say today the service that the region needs would be met if we didn't, or if someone didn't provide those buses. The other one I had wanted to ask about was the B8 and B9. That was by far the most controversial discussion at the public hearing. And if I read the recommendation correctly, what you're saying is keep the service in Fort Lincoln, maybe reroute it a little to make it work. What I don't understand is that red, green, yellow chart that you showed us that put that line in the green category of people were happy.
So yeah.
They weren't happy at the event that I went to.
They were not.
Yeah, I think we had the entire ANC attending the public hearing.
Yeah.
And so you
heard maybe the entire population of Fort Lincoln, but they were.
The customer input reflects input from the whole universe of people who commented, and they indicated
and they commented specifically on the B8, B9.
The B8, B9 would be an area where has some merit because you have both the H6 and the B8, B9 serving that neighborhood. The primary issue is that folks like the option of being able to get to Rhode Island Avenue and the development there, in addition to being able to get to Brooklyn and the education and employment opportunities at that location. And as many things do, it comes down to the grocery store of choice.
Yeah.
The one the community has been going to for a number of years is just across the city line in Maryland, and the B8, B9 goes there, and they wanted to preserve that access, and we're happy to do so. The rerouting is something we've actually been waiting a number of years for. Commodore Joshua Varney Road will finally be open, and when it does, this will give us the authority to be able to operate on it and get to the Costco and the other development at that Fort Lincoln.
And the other thing I would note is the 15M that runs empty buses through my neighborhood day after day after day is being eliminated, and I think very few people will miss it because very few people ride it.
And Mr. Goldman will call.
Yes, thank you. Again, a few more comments on the 5A, since I was the party who urged that it be included in this review of buses. And I think in this case, the public hearing process has been extremely valuable because it's shown that the 5A does have a ridership and the 5A should be continued. I think we saw in the public hearing process, as your chart indicated, that a large number of airport workers came out and they depend on the 5A because, as Ms. Hines points out, it gets them there before the first train, Silverline train, would get them to Dulles. And it's also probably faster. It's a good deal of the testimony that being able to go on the 5A was faster. We also learned in the public hearing process and in studies that you did that there's a strong, not insignificant number of Maryland residents who ride the 5A, between 15 and 19%. So for all those reasons, I think the public hearing process was a very valuable one. And I don't participate in this committee, so when it comes before the board, I will vote in favor of the staff recommendation that the 5A be continued, at least until the subway, until the metro gets to Dulles. I did have one question, though, about your slide on the 5A, and that's to better understand what you refer to it as staff recommends retaining existing service due to public input, which I understand that from public, and line productivity. What does line productivity mean?
Well, in this case, it actually reflects several elements. One, it has the highest fare box recovery ratio of any line that we operate. It's double what the next closest service is at somewhere between 60 and 65% cost recovery. Secondly, it's mid-pack for Virginia services when it comes to passengers per trip or passengers per revenue hour. And the subsidy per passenger is equal to the 2A or 2B or some of the other arterial services that we operate. So on the whole, it is performing as well as many of the services are in Virginia that don't have a 18-mile long trip with which to contend.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Trigalian had a question.
I just wanted to comment about how impressed I was with the public outreach that was done and how detailed the analysis was that you were able to distinguish between people who commented who were regular riders, how you reached out based on Smart Trip cards to get to the buses. I mean, it seems like that opens the potential for lots of other things that you could do with that information. You mentioned the example of a particular grocery store and a customer population that's dependent on service. I mean, that seems like perfectly designed for a co-marketing opportunity with that grocery store. And I don't know. I'm not saying that that's how all this data should be used, but that I did find the level of analysis very sophisticated and very helpful, and I think it very much informed a proposal that I'm very happy to support. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bowersox is grinning that she'll follow up, and maybe the McKinsey recommendation will come
and
up.
And I think we'll be waiting for the afternoon discussion as well. Thank you. I thank you, Ms. Sambry, for the report and for the process. I think this is a good way to continue to emphasize the manner in which we save money, in which we improve services. We look to provide a more efficient service with cost neutral, and the process works quite well, and the improvement of public input is really a very important one. The 5A really does represent the need for the discussion in order to make the decision as wholesome as possible. I could be parochial and say, well, we really don't need it, but we do need it because we do want to get those folks to work, and it does provide a larger connectivity to the other part of Northern Virginia, so it gives us a lot of insight. With that, I think it's time to call a question. All those in favor that we move forward with recommendations, please say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed? Thank you very much for this. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.